This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
You'll be facing a deceptive enemy, which is likely to use asymmetric warfare, unconventional and underhand warfare tactics against yourself and the population you'll be protecting.
That's Botswanan President Mokgweetsi Masisi, as he saw troops being sent to join SADC contingent tasked with quelling Mozambique's brutal insurgency. Details coming up. Also, Tunisia's president ousts the government and freezes parliament. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The U.S. Africa Command launched a strike against Somali terrorist group Al-Shabaab on Friday to lend U.S. air power to what has been described as a fierce ground struggle between the Somali military and Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab. It was the second airstrike in the past week, following a nearly six-month hiatus that began when President Joe Biden took office. David DeRoche, associate professor at the Defense University, discussed these developments with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Al-Shenawi.
Well, I think that the Biden honeymoon, the idea that he has a period where he can try bold policy actions to see what happens, that's come to an end. He's announced the withdrawal from Afghanistan. There's continuing attacks on U.S. and Western forces in Iraq. And he had announced the withdrawal of U.S. ground forces from Somalia. French forces have announced their withdrawal from Mali. I think now he's realized that there are some bad things starting to happen that will reverberate in a security environment globally, but also politically against Joe Biden and against his supporters in Congress in the elections that will be held next year. So I think he's now listening more to folks in the military who are saying, look, we're going to get some bad results here. And I think he's having to take action.
A security report said that Al-Shabaab group has significantly increased its use of drones to conduct reconnaissance flyovers and record the activities of security forces, warning that Al-Shabaab may soon start weaponizing the drones as well. How serious would be that?
It's pretty serious, but it's not unexpected. Look, drones are available globally. States all around the world are now modifying drones or adapting drones or purchasing drones to use as weapons. And non-state actors have weaponized them as well. Daesh in the Battle of Mosul managed to improvise commercial drones to deliver explosives. And they were so effective that the Iraqi security forces had to stop ground operations for 2 days. The Somali forces and a lot of the forces that are supporting the Somali forces in Somalia are not trained to a level that would allow them to deal with drones. And we don't have, you know, one technical solution for drones. We have to use a lot of different solutions that we're still trying to figure out. So this is a potentially complicating issue for the success of the counter Al-Shabaab mission in Somalia. And I think it's something that the U.S. and that other countries are taking very seriously.
AFRICOM Commander General Stephen Townsend said that the spread of terrorism has continued relatively unabated across Africa, and he singled out Al-Shabaab as a major concern. Those concerns are being echoed by intelligence agencies from other countries and the UN monitors, who warned in a report released on Friday that Al-Shabaab has been successfully exploiting a security vacuum created by the departure of U.S. troops and a partial drawdown of the African Union mission in Somalia. If that is the case, what is the needed action?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, look, there was an element of risk in the withdrawal of U.S. forces. Politically, nobody in the United States really supports a ground mission for American forces in Somalia or indeed anywhere in Africa. We see it as peripheral to our national security interests, but that's the political statement. Strategically and militarily, we know that you have to have some U.S. forces or forces with a similar advanced industrial capability like NATO forces in order to effectively support an African Union in its indigenous Somali capability. So what we're seeing now is the military reaction to a political decision. And basically, I think what the Biden administration and what AFRICOM is doing is taking corrective action to prevent a failure of the mission in Somalia that would then be a political disaster for the Biden administration.
That was David DeRoche, associate professor at the Defense University, speaking with my colleague Mohammed Al-Shanawi. Tunisia's President Kais Saied has ousted the government and frozen parliament for a month in what Reuters called the country's crisis in a decade of democracy. For now, the move yesterday seems to be backed by the army. It came about after months of deadlock and disputes between Saied, a political independent, and Prime Minister Hichem Mechichi, as the fragmented parliament kept descending deeper into an economic crisis exacerbated by the COVID pandemic. Parliament Speaker Rashid Ghannouchi, the head of the moderate Islamist Ennahda party, decried the president's moves and urged people to protest in the streets. On this first World Drowning Prevention Day, the World Health Organization offers life-saving solutions to prevent most of the 236,000 estimated deaths from drowning every year. The United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution in April establishing this International Day to raise awareness of drowning as a serious problem. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Summertime has been celebrated in song as the season when the living is easy. On a less celebratory note, summertime in the Northern Hemisphere also is the peak season for deaths by drowning. Over the past decade, the World Health Organization reports 2.5 million people have died in drowning incidents. It says more than half of all drowning deaths are among people under age 30, with the highest rates among children under the age of 5. David Meddings, a WHO medical officer, says drowning is the second leading cause of death among children and youth under age 19 in wealthy countries such as the United States, Switzerland, and France. He notes, though, drowning disproportionately affects the poor and the marginalized.
The rates for drowning in low and middle income countries are 3 times higher than the rates we observe in high income countries. And so it's really the populations with the least resources to be able to adapt to the threats around them that are at highest risk for drowning. The Western Pacific region has the world's highest drowning rates, followed by the African region.
WHO reports more than 90% of drowning deaths occur in rivers, lakes, wells, irrigation canals, and even domestic water storage vessels in the poorer countries. It says children and adolescents in rural areas are disproportionately affected. Medding says national surveys in Africa show most drownings occur among young adult men out on fishing vessels.
For example, there was a study done in Tanzania among lakeside communities that showed that the risk of death from drowning exceeded the risk of death in that population for death from HIV, TB, or malaria. So 80% of deaths occurring in young adult men who are, in a sense, obligated to go out on fishing vessels that often are inherently unsafe watercraft without advanced weather warning and without knowing how to swim.
The report does not include statistics on flood-related mortality. Deaths due to water transport mishaps, such as capsized ferry boats, or migrant deaths that occur while crossing the perilous Mediterranean Sea. WHO recommends a number of cost-effective, life-saving measures. It says children should be taught basic swimming and water safety skills. Wells and potentially dangerous water areas should be fenced off, and bystanders should be trained in safe rescue and resuscitation. It says safe boating and ferry regulations should be enforced and calls for flood risk management to be improved. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africans have welcomed President Cyril Ramaphosa's announcement that bans on alcohol sales and public gatherings are over and schools are reopening. Ramaphosa said the country's third wave of COVID-19 infections is on a downward trajectory. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
The alcohol industry, which was hardest hit throughout the restrictions, was the biggest winner, with Ramaphosa saying he was ending a two-week ban on booze sales. Batches of alcohol for off-site consumption is now permitted from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Monday to Thursday. On-site consumption is okay until 8 p.m.
Non-essential establishments such as restaurants, taverns, bars, and fitness centers may be opened. These establishments will, however, need to close by 9 p.m. to allow their employees and patrons to travel home before the start of the curfew.
Lucky Dimane is the president of the National Liquor Traders Council.
Almost over 1 million jobs are at stake, just as alcohol industry and value chain. But if we look at the hospitality sector, it's about 750,000 jobs. Are we then saying that we need to continue with a ban as a strategy for government to fight COVID-19? We do not think that this is a sustainable way, but we should be able to work together with government, and our doors are open so that we can find a long-term sustainable solution.
Religious and other gatherings are now permitted with a maximum of 50 people indoors and 100 outdoors. This has been welcomed by religious organizations. Curfew hours are now 10 p.m. to 4 a.m., but the restaurant industry wants the curfew ended. A ban on interprovincial leisure travel has also been lifted. Ramaphosa said daily average infections have fallen to 12,000 from the 20s. The government has also announced a string of relief measures to employees who have lost their jobs as a result of COVID-19 and to companies affected by recent looting.
To support those who have no means of supporting themselves, we are reinstating the Social Relief of Disaster Grant to provide a monthly payment of 350 until the end of March 2022.
The government is also scaling up its vaccination programs, with over 200,000 people being inoculated each day. However, anti-vaccination groups are also growing. Josh Swart was part of an anti-vaccine march in Cape Town.
We don't want to be subjected to curfews, we don't want to be subjected to wearing masks, and we definitely don't want to be subjected to any narrative that is going along the lines of forced vaccines to enter into public spaces.
To date, over 2 million people have been infected by the coronavirus in South Africa, and over 69,000 have died. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Some political analysts say the recent outbreak of violence in South Africa shows the ruling African National Congress, or ANC, is weaker than ever. 2 weeks ago, people looted stores, destroyed warehouses and factories, and blocked highways with burning trucks. The unrest left more than 200 dead and was sparked by the jailing of former President Jacob Zuma for contempt of court. The government of President Cyril Ramaphosa has accused several Zuma loyalists of instigating what it labeled an attempted insurrection. Darren Taylor has more.
South Africa's Center for Risk Analysis says the climate in the country now is similar to what it was in the late 1980s and early 1990s. Volatile, with extremely low economic growth, political disillusionment, and security forces that seem unable to maintain law and order. Then, says Director Franz Cronier, after the country's first democratic elections in 1994, Nelson Mandela dedicated his administration to economic pragmatism. It didn't go into debt to fund social welfare, for example. His successor, Thabo Mbeki, was equally conservative. And 13 years into power, says Cronier, the ANC ran a budget surplus. Employment rates were rising.
Government debt levels were cut in half. And despite that and the fiscal prudence, we rolled out as a country the most expansive social welfare system of any emerging market that did a lot of good to raise the basic living standards of poor people. And what was at the core of that? Of course, there were.
Cronier says Mandela and Mbeki realized that for South Africa to grow, it needed to draw high levels of investment. Things weren't perfect, he says, but both administrations used investment revenues to lift people out of poverty.
In 2004, a decade after Mandela had led the ANC to freedom and victory. Under Mbeki, the ANC was 6 percentage points stronger than it had been under Mr. Mandela. And the reason was that it was getting it right, and life was improving and getting better for almost all South Africans. The party threw that away.
At the ANC's conference in 2007, it rejected Mbeki as its leader in favor of Jacob Zuma. The following year, Zuma was elected president, and so began almost a decade of what some South Africans describe as its darkest days in the democratic era. The Zuma administration allegedly looted anti-poverty programs and state enterprises of billions of dollars. South Africa plunged into massive debt. Government companies and municipalities went bankrupt. The party ousted Zuma in early 2018, and Cyril Ramaphosa became president. He and the party promised reforms, some which happened, but unemployment, inequality, and poverty continue to soar. Cronier says as a result, there'll be further outbreaks of public violence in the years to come. But he argues that South Africa's future isn't as bleak as many now think. He predicts that the country, just like in 1994, will eventually choose democracy over anarchy.
And my call to clients over the recent past, I mean, that would be a couple of years, has been, I think the ANC is going to lose an election. And I think it could lose in 2024. And if it doesn't lose in 2024 and we maintain the basic trappings of being a democracy, I cannot see that the ANC will have a national majority over South Africa by the end of the 2020s. And that's partly, of course, our intuition and experience.
An ANC loss at the polls, says Cronier, will ignite reform.
The ANC defeat will be the catalyst for the emergence of a new political movement, an echo of the gear era of Mandela and Mbeki. South Africa will, led by this new group, recover strongly through the 2030s to become one of the world's most exciting emerging markets. This ends for the ANC perfectly democratically.
Cronier is often criticized in South Africa for so-called Afro-pessimism and conservatism. So, he says, when someone like him goes out on a limb to forecast a bright future for a nation that's just endured its biggest explosion of public violence in its democratic history, he should be taken seriously. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
A man accused of trying to kill Mali's military strongman, Assimi Goïta, has died in custody. According to the French news agency AFP, the suspect, whose name was never revealed, was taken into custody following the assassination attempt last Tuesday. Armed with a knife, he lunged at Goïta after prayers for Eid al-Adha. A government statement says the suspect was hospitalized as his health deteriorated. It added that an autopsy has been ordered to determine the cause of death. Botswana sent 296 troops to Mozambique today to join soldiers from other Southern Africa Development Community or SADC countries. The SADC troops are being deployed for the first time to help quell a deadly Islamist insurgency in Cabo Delgado, Mozambique's northmost province. Mokadisi Dube reports from Habrone.
President Mokgweetsi Masisi saw off the troops at the Sesere Tsakama International Airport in the capital Monday morning. Masisi, who is the chairperson of the SADC organ on politics, defense and security, says the deployment is part of the region's effort to promote stability in member nation Mozambique.
Today we witness yet another milestone in our set out objectives of propelling the peace agenda to our region, in following through on the SADC mandate aimed at facilitating the peaceful conditions in the northern part of the Republic of Mozambique, in Cabo Delgado in particular.
Masisi warns the troops to brace for an unconventional war in Cabo Delgado.
I'm alive to the fact that you'll be facing a deceptive enemy, which is likely to use asymmetric warfare, unconventional and underhand warfare tactics against yourselves and the population you'll be protecting. As professionals, you stand for much more than they do and must avoid emulating them and sink into their level.
Botswana becomes the second SADC nation to send troops to Cabo Delgado after South African soldiers landed in Mozambique last week. Rwanda, which is not a member of the regional 16-member bloc, also sent 1,000 troops earlier this month. Adriano Nuvunga, director of the Center for Democracy and Development in Maputo, welcomes the arrival of foreign troops but is worried about the coordination of the operation.
These are troops from different nations, different cultures, different codes of operation. It's a further challenge for Mozambique to coordinate this. It's a further militarization which can fuel the conflict with consequences for local communities, for humanitarian situation and abuse of human rights.
Last month, SADC resolved to send troops to fight Islamist insurgents in the oil-rich Cabo Delgado region. The civil unrest has claimed the lives of nearly 3,000 people, while an estimated 800,000 people have been displaced. Kondisi Dube for VOA News, Haburoni, Botswana.
A Nigerian court has postponed the trial of a separatist leader after officials did not bring him to the proceedings that were scheduled to resume today. Namidi Kanu, leader of the banned Indigenous People of Biafra IPOB organization, faces 11 charges, including treason. Kanu's lawyer, Ifanye Ijofor, said he had not been allowed to see his client for 8 days ahead of the hearing. The judge ordered that Kanu should have access to his lawyers twice a week. Amnesty International has called for Nigerian authorities to respect the right to a fair hearing and immediately lift restrictions so media have unhindered access to report on the trial. Calls for a separatist state in southeastern Nigeria are just one of the challenges facing President Muhammadu Buhari's government ahead of the 2023 election. Here is VOA's Tokyo 2020 roundup of Olympic action for Africa and around the world. Tunisian swimmer Ahmed Hafnaoui became the first African to bag a gold medal at the 2020 Tokyo Olympics, finishing first in men's 400-meter freestyle yesterday. It was the second medal for Tunisia in Tokyo after Mohamed Khalil Jandoubi won a silver medal in men's 58-kilogram taekwondo. Zimbabwe's teenage swimming sensation Donata Katai on Sunday failed to reach the semifinals of the 100-meter backstroke despite recording a personal best and coming first in her heat at the Aquatic Center in Tokyo. On the first day of the men's basketball tournament, Nigeria's men started with an 84-67 loss against Australia. The Nigerian men and women's teams are the only African basketball teams in Tokyo. South Africa's men and women hockey teams started off with losses at the Summer Games. Great Britain beat the South African men 3-1 on Saturday. The South Africans then lost again 5-3 to Netherlands on Sunday. South African women fell 2-0 to Ireland. They will face Great Britain tomorrow. In the preliminary rounds of the table tennis tournament, Ofeong Edem lifted up Nigeria with a 4-1 victory over Dora Madaraz of Hungary. But Olofunke Oshonki from Nigeria was dominated 1-4 by Juan Louis of USA, while Cameroon's Sara Hanifu lost to Bulgaria's Polina Trifonova 1-4. On the men's side, Senegal's Ibrahima Diaw ended with a tough 2-4 loss against Singapore's Clarence Chu Ziyu. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehinyi Swuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokwili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.